Welcome back to the Four Idle Hands podcast. Welcome, Terry, to our very own Halloween special.
I mean, welcome. Are you a fan of the Halloween sort of holiday season sort of?
I mean, it's, you know, the thing I think in Britain is that it's regarded as being some sort of American import. But actually in Ireland, it's a fairly big deal. You get a day or two off school and the like. And it's a sort of pagan festival, isn't it? That's been kind of appropriated by other religions because it's All Saints Day the following day.
It is. And I was thinking back to when I was at school in we're talking Northern Ireland here, obviously. And I lived out in the country a little bit, so we didn't go trick-or-treating, but we used to occasionally go into friends' houses for sort of Halloween parties. But I don't remember people trick-or-treating in Northern Ireland. Knocking on the door, looking for sweets.
No. I'll tell you a little related story, and that is when I was a kid, fireworks south of the border were prohibited, and yes, in actual fact, I think they still are.
Same, yeah.
And I remember being probably about maybe 11 or 12 and going into a shop up in Armagh and asking if they had any bangers. Armagh is the other side of the border. Obviously, when it was all kicking off back in the 70s, and I got pretty short shrift from the shopkeeper, I didn't ask that again.
I think fireworks are allowed in the north now, but I think, I mean, that's only recently. I don't think it was certainly through the Troubles. You couldn't have bought fire. They have licensed displays now, but I'm still not sure they sell them for public use, for private use anyway. So, but anyway,
yeah. So, and of course, we'll come back to Halloween in particular later on. But before that, we're just going to run through a couple of wee news bits. And there is a link, Terry, because Guy Fawkes tried to burn down Westminster not so long ago, and the Tories have been doing a pretty good job with the last couple of weeks.
I mean, you really couldn't. I mean, the political journalists, we've said this before, must be this Christmas, New Year, Halloween, birthdays come at once. They must be loving this. There's so much stuff to talk about. And obviously, we have a new PM this very day called Rishi turned up. Or as someone said yesterday in an interview, yeah, that guy, Richie, I'm not sure about him. I can't remember where it was, Bolton or somewhere. But you couldn't write it. 44 days later, and we've got another PM.
Yeah, well, I did, of course, predict it a long time ago, but I don't think I was necessarily a soothsayer to be able to work out that Truss just wasn't up to the job. Did you know, Terry, that in a previous life, before she was in politics, she was an accountant?
Yes, and she was an accountant for Shell as well, Shell Oil Company.
Well, there you go.
In London, so... But again, looking into Halloween, we could have had a back from the dead scenario this week with Boris turning up. I mean, I just can't believe they thought that would be a good idea.
I mean, there were certainly those photographs that they allowed for press coverage when he got off the plane from the Dominican Republic. I mean, there was something fairly ghoulish and hungover looking about him, wasn't there?
I mean, he'd been staying at some five-star, 500 quid a night, you know, fancy resort, which I guess would be paid for by a donor potentially. And as someone pointed out, I saw on social media, Parliament is currently sitting, so why wasn't he in Parliament as an MP? But I guess it's one rule for them and one rule for me. But yeah, he didn't look the best, I have to say, but no.
He certainly likes to think that the rules don't apply to him. I mean, a couple of observations on it. Johnson just hasn't got a clue, has he? He was apparently ringing around colleagues begging for them to back him. And you know, this is after he'd had something like 50 resignations from his cabinet only a matter of a couple of months ago. But apparently he also claimed to them that Sunak would be implicated by the Privilege Committee into Partygate as well, you know? I mean, it's like kettle and pot. He just doesn't really get it.
I'm trying to imagine what's going to happen next, because I don't think this is the end of it. I mean, to give Boris some credit, I guess, is he had the sense to pull out of it and, you know, realise that, you know, he stood and they had a vote. He probably would have got in, possibly. Certainly the membership probably would have gone for him, I'm guessing. But I mean, they've been an absolute disaster. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon was just like lining up for a home run at that, like, so
Oh
just,
yeah.
you
And
know.
Truss apparently today her chief of staff Mark Fulbrook has been pushing for her aides to get resignation honours, despite her government only being up and running for about 7 weeks. I mean, they've got brass necks, this lot, haven't they?
Well, I mean, maybe they deserve that for lasting 44 days. I mean, maybe that's what they need, you know, an MBE. But she's going to get her 115 grand a year. What do you, some sort of special thing they get as prime minister, like a it's not a pension, but it's an allowance they get.
Yeah.
I mean, I would take that for 44 days work.
Sure, and I would have done a better job than her as well. Go back to Sunak, a couple of things about him. Obviously, you know, he is the first Asian prime minister, which is quite something, particularly for the Tories, I think, without tarring
Yep.
them all with one brush. But he's also the first Goldman Sachs employee to become prime minister. Now, Terry, he doesn't mention Goldman Sachs in his LinkedIn profile. Has he got something to hide about that?
I mean, I assume he was some sort of, was he a trader? What was he doing? A banker,
He was an
perhaps.
analyst, so these guys, you know, they look at company filings and go to annual general meetings and updates from big companies, and they basically try and put a value on them to determine whether these are companies that should be recommended for investing in or taking over, that kind of thing.
So he was basically Gordon Gecko, wasn't he? That's kind of what he
Exactly.
was. Yeah. But it's funny, the company I work for, we used to be owned by Goldman Sachs. Part owned. I mean, they had loads of investors, but they were one of the big ones. And every 6 months, the Goldman Sachs guy would turn up in the offices. And because somebody wanted to show him some reality, you would get landed with this guy for an hour to tell him about the business and all the rest. And, you know, I mean, they were bankers for sure, but what always got me was they were so young, these people. You were speaking to this guy, he was looked like he was out of school. Super intelligent, no doubt about it. But the guy was telling me about the next morning he was going first class to New York for a meeting for 3 hours and first class back to London and stuff. And I'm like, so I'm pretty sure that's the world of which he lived in. But his wife's paying tax now, so that's good. She's paying
Yeah,
tax everywhere. Everywhere she could, she's paying it. Giving tips and tips. Tips everywhere.
she didn't make an appearance this morning, which is unsurprising. Something that came up on social media earlier was the similarity between Sunak's speaking voice, which is like a bit kind of twee, probably describe it, and Will out of The Inbetweeners. So if you go and have a listen to Will and listen to Rishi, you can't unhear it after that.
No, I did see a thing on the old socials yesterday, and it was John Baird, Peterhead film director, had commented on his delivery that, you know, he was obviously reading from a auto cue, which is as per normal these days, but not looking at the camera. He was looking somewhere up above, and you know, because of that, it doesn't look very engaging. And his delivery was I mean, for somebody, you know, fairly polished, his delivery was awful. It wasn't. It didn't make you feel, oh, you know, warm and positive feeling, but then we don't expect that, do we? So,
No, they're Tories after all, so
yeah, it's exactly. We are never would detest them, obviously. So,
anyway, one of the side benefits of all this, Terry, is that Jacob Rees-Mogg has resigned from the cabinet, and so has Brandon Lewis, who is an awful waste of space as well. So they've got their jotters. No doubt there'll be some other idiots will be in post in their positions before too long.
But absolutely, and this will be marked as a day in history for sure, 1983. Well, you were talking about 1983 as well today, weren't you? So,
Oh yes, well actually, do you know what? I am looking at my computer screen here, which I got some notes about this podcast on, and I'm looking at Microsoft's Word, and Microsoft Word was launched on this day in 1983, Terry, and the world changed a wee bit when that happened, didn't it?
well. Yeah, I mean, I remember. I mean, these days you got to have and pay for it. The other day, and I had to renew my billing subscription to Microsoft 365. It used to be free, and now you have to pay for it. Anyway, so, but I mean, that was the kind of start of the home computing revolution, on that. So, Word and then PowerPoint, and PowerPoint ruins people's lives these days. But that's another story. But
Yeah.
yeah, Word processing it was called.
Yes, and thank you for that, Bill. One of the few things we could probably thank him for. Well, that's not true, actually. It's been unfair.
Well, 1983 was also the day the iPod launched, the first one, apparently. Not 1983, but on this day, October 23rd, 2001, or something, I think it was.
Right, and this is also the anniversary of the US invasion of Grenada as well. I remember there was a joke going around in Ireland. This is back in 1983, obviously. There was a joke going around Dublin about Reagan invading Grenada, and the man says, "Who wants to invade a car anyway?"
But they made a great movie with Clint Eastwood about the invasion of Grenada, and it's just totally gone from my head now, actually. So, but
It couldn't have been that
I just suddenly thinking, there we go. But so.
Now, I'm going to add something to the agenda here, Terry, because while I was waiting for you to get your technological problem sorted out there, somebody had tweeted about Kanye West, and he's been cancelled everywhere because of some anti-Semitic comments that he made. So he's been temporarily, at least, banned from Instagram and Twitter. Adidas have cut all ties with them. So have Balenciaga. Vogue don't want to have anything to do with him. He's been dropped by his lawyer and by the CAA talent agency in Los Angeles. His stadium shows have been cancelled, and the documentary that he was making has been shelved as well.
That's good news, I would say, for the world. But
Absolutely.
I would like to point out, though, if Adidas would like somebody new to kind of be an image, I'd be up for that.
Yeah.
And I just before I left the office today, I was on the Adidas website, looking for a World Cup football shirt. So, I mean, feel free, I'm up for it. But I mean, he's been caught in trouble for getting close to the wind for years. But I mean, I think he has got over the edge now, from what I see.
Yeah.
I
Yeah,
mean.
that was a career decision that he's made there. So we can look forward to hearing a lot less from him, I think.
But what's his name is Yi now. Yi. Maybe we should like have new names. You could be and I could be Ooh, or
You could be Tez.
I couldn't find the World Cup shirt, by the way. I was trying to find one. I always buy a shirt for the World Cup, and I was trying to pick a shirt of a team that's going to qualify because you want to get your money's worth. So you can wear it like for the knockout, but I didn't want a big team. So could you have a guess what team I'd? You won't guess, but have a punt at what team I picked in the end.
That you wanted to buy, but you couldn't buy.
I couldn't buy it today. It wasn't available till the 10th of November, apparently.
Ooh, Belgium?
Non-European.
Oh, non-European, Qatar.
Oh God, no!
Oh,
Japan.
pretty good, yeah.
It was red, white, and blue. That wasn't the reason, but it is. But I was chatting to somebody else on Twitter today, and I thought, oh yeah, I was looking for a shirt, and I thought Japan or Korea. Korea was disgusting, so I thought I'll settle for Japan. So, but and it's only 40 days till the World, or in fact less, 30 days till the World Cup starts, which also
I
isn't on our
know.
agenda. But there we go.
And I know, as the guy says in Bad Day at Black Rock, I'm consumed with apathy. The whole idea of it being on in Qatar is just going to ruin it for me. And yeah, they're just going to suck all the fun out of it.
Well, I'm interested to see it. I mean, there's going to be four games a day apparently, starting because it's quite decent times for us, I think. But the games are they're like early morning and then they're late afternoon sort of thing. So, but yeah, it'll be a feast of commerciality, that's for sure. Like so.
Oh yes, yes indeed. Slightly less commercial. We're into award seasons, Terry, and we in the last week or so we've had the Say Award, which is the Scottish Album of the Year awards, and also the Mercury's, which had been delayed because I think they were actually in the process of finalising the ceremony on the night that Her Madge passed away, so they had to postpone it, obviously. So the Say Award is Scottish Album of the Year won by Fergus MacCready for his Forest Floor album. Have you ever
Yeah,
listened to this?
I have because I was intrigued because I have to be honest and sorry, apologies to Fergus, that never heard of him before. So, in fact, I have to hold my hand up here. quite a few of the Say Award lists I had not heard of before. Interesting enough, on the night, the artist that kicked off the evening was a girl called Itie, who is from Aberdeen. And from what I can see, got very little publicity in the Aberdeen media and press about it. But she'd played it True North and she's just kicked it off. But I did listen to the album and it's excellent. I mean, I'm not a jazz fan. I don't think I listen to very much jazz, but it's very good. It's just pretty much what you'd expect. But that's I really enjoyed it. Actually. It does sound very Scottish as well. But
It does, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
it, on the Say Awards website, it describes the album as a unique blend of jazz and Scottish folk music inspired by Scotland's sublime landscapes. And you really do get that kind of folk motif running through it.
Yeah, the first song I listened to, I didn't get that. Then the second one, which I wrote down the title for, which I think was The Unfurrowed Field, and just the piano just sounds a bit like a Scottish reel, to kind of jazz beat. And no, I thought it was excellent. I listened to it a couple of times, and I thought this guy's a bit of a talent. And then I kind of started looking into him further, and I was looking at videos of him playing. It was one of him playing in Calton Hill in Edinburgh, him and a saxophone player. But yeah, obviously a very talented guy.
Yeah, I mean, his band are a trio, but they
Yeah.
fairly fill out the sound. I mean, particularly the piano. He's an amazing player, I would say. So well done, Fergus, and look forward to hearing some more from him in due course. Mercury Awards winner was Little Sims' album, Sometimes I Might Be Introvert. What do you make of that, Terry?
I think that was okay. I mean, I'm glad it wasn't any of the kind of big artists like Sam Fender or Harry Styles that got in for that, which I still don't really get why they put them in, because you'd imagine the Mercury Prize Award is at 25 grand to get. And to give that to Harry Styles would just be wrong, I think. I mean, and the publicity, he's got enough publicity. A good award. I mean, Fergus was also up for a Mercury Prize. But I think that's a fairly good recipient. I've not listened a lot to her music, but I mean, from what I hear, pretty decent stuff. And yeah, well done, I think so.
Yeah, well, I have been keeping an eye on her for some years, and I'd say she's a pretty precocious talent and a very kind of melodic rapper, really. And I was just watching her singing a song after the award had been given, and honestly, you'd need a very fast moving auto cue to remember all the lyrics for her, Terry. There must have been thousands of words just in one song. So well done her. The other candidate album I would have thought was in with a chance of winning it was Self-Esteem's Prioritized Pleasure, which was very different in terms of the musical style and lyrical content. But Little Sims, I think, is a worthy winner.
It was interesting last night. So I was watching some videos of Ross McCready, and some what was it now? So we were also watching last night the season, no spoilers, the season finale of House of the Dragon, which we can cover later on some other point, some other podcast. But what was interesting and what connects these two things was, after we watched Ross McCready video, the next video it suggested for me, for some reason on YouTube, was Park Life by Blur. Not quite sure why. So there we go. So we watched that one. And Stuart had never seen the Park Life video, or maybe didn't remember it, with Phil Daniels. And I said, oh, he's in House of the Dragon. And he is. He plays like a maester, like an old kind of sort of guy in it. He doesn't, and unfortunately, he doesn't say very much. And I thought, what an odd role, because he's obviously been in Quadrophenia over the years and doing different things, but to have a role in such a big TV show and not really to have any good lines seemed a complete waste. So we went back and watched it again because we thought, is it him? It definitely was.
But he got a trip to New Zealand out of it, though, did he?
Well, oh no, I think it was Dorset. I think they filmed it in Dorset or down the south of England. I think that was Lord of the Rings. Yeah, but there we go. Anyway, it's a good video. But yeah, and well done, Little Sims. That was excellent.
Yeah, well done, Little Sims. Right, okay, it's time for a big interview this week, and it is a big, massive metal interview,
Oh,
isn't it?
it is. I think these guys. I mean, okay, they're of all the bands over the years for metal fans, these guys are iconic, I would say. I would agree with that.
Yeah, in a heartwarming kind of way as well, yeah.
I mean, they didn't headline the mon they weren't headlining Monsters of Rock at Donington. They might have been on the bill further down, but I would say it would be slightly hard done by. Would that be fair?
Yes, and they've been playing the long game, Terry, and things have come good for them. We are, of course, talking about Anvil, and we spoke to Steve Lipscudlow and Rob Reiner just before their gig in Bournemouth the other day. Here's our chat with them. We're joined tonight by certifiable rock legends Anvil, so it's a big four idle hands. Welcome to Steve Lipscudlow and Rob Reiner from the band. How are you guys?
Yeah, good. Good.
You just finished your sound check for your gig in Bournemouth tonight. It's Anvil playing the Anvil, and you're heading towards the end of your UK tour with this just one more gig to go, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. One more tomorrow night.
Okay. Great.
It's been a great run. It's been a really good run. Best run we've done here yet.
Okay. It's funny, the company I work for has got an office in Bournemouth, and I was just asking people today about the Anvil, and turns out they were going to the gig tonight. So it's like, hey guys, that should be fun. So they were looking forward to it.
Well, it's a small place. It's sold out, so.
Oh, excellent. Is it downstairs, like in a basement?
Yeah, it's a fucking dungeon.
So you're probably about as far away from us as you could possibly get in the UK. So we're in Aberdeen in Scotland. And I read somewhere that you were once going to be called Boil the Haggis. Is that right? No, maybe not.
No, that was an insane suggestion from a record company executive who's a fucking retard, and he suggested that as a name, and he was serious about it, which was even funnier.
I mean, a boiled haggis is nice stuff, you know, for a good for a hangover. So I mean, it wouldn't be a horrendous name.
Call the man Boil the Haggis. Sure, why not?
But I have to say, Anvil is 1,000% better, guys. So that's cool. Well, one thing, I was reading your book, The Story of Anvil, and it's fairly a fantastic story. But I mean, touring over the years, you guys got in a lot of trouble before. It must be pretty calm these days. Is it not quite as wild, or
The trouble with what?
just, parties and just living life on the road and all the expectations and stuff that you read about it. So,
Yeah, well, you know what? Debauchery ended in about 1984. Yeah,
okay.
it couldn't be any more fucking boring hanging around this band. It's fucking death warmed over most of the time. Sleeping.
Sleeping, okay.
Like a geriatric fucking joint.
I mean, but you guys have known each other since what, the late 70s? I mean, is that right? You guys were at school, or how did you guys meet?
Oh, well, that's back to that.
Back to that.
Back to that, fucking old chestnut, huh? Oh, you want to tell the story?
Go ahead. My guess, I'm tired of it.
Okay.
Well, we don't need details, like, so.
Well, we met through a mutual friend when we were kids at a jam.
Okay.
How's that?
All the way from school then.
Yeah.
So what kind of stuff did you, those days, I mean, what did you listen to then? I know what I was listening to sort of late 70s. I was kind of more into punk and then getting into heavy metal. Was it kind of same for you guys, or was it more sort of 70s rock, or what was it?
Well, 60s, 70s, heavy blues
Okay.
is what we kind of grew up on. Hard
Okay.
rock, heavy blues, hard rock.
Someone just phoned my phone there. So your debut album, Hard and
That's
Heavy,
the
yeah.
environment.
So you guys played Monster of Rock in 1982 here in Donington. And I was looking at the bill today, and I mean, you guys and Saxon were probably the freshest bands on the bill. I mean, did that concert feel like things were changing in the heavy metal world? Because obviously the rest was States Quo, Gillan, Hawkwind, Uriah Heep. Which, I mean, you guys were certainly on the kind of more energetic.
No offense, but I'm trying to see the relevance of what talking about something that happened over 40 years ago.
Well, yeah, people like that sort of thing, though, so.
No, I'm just wondering, why are we talking about something that happened over 40 years ago? That's what it's kind of a, yeah, we played Donington, we were the first band on. It sucked shit. I felt like my career ended the day that it started. It was an awful experience. Because at that in that day and age, they threw mud and piss bottles at everybody. So We found that extraordinarily shocking and disappointing.
Yeah. But we were green and young and inexperienced, so we had no idea really the reality before us.
Okay.
No one warned us, and then of course we watched as the day or two went by, including the Reading Festival, and everybody had that done to them. And we're going, man, it's just, we hate festivals.
Well, I saw you at a festival not that long after that. You played in a gig at a football stadium in Dublin in 1983, which is...
Golly, man.
Yeah.
It was called the Garden Party. So that was Black Sabbath with Ian Gillan on vocals, Motorhead with Brian Robertson. You guys were on the bill, and Twisted Sister as well. And the thing that struck me about that gig that day, and you know, your performance in particular, was that I think your style of music, in terms of you know the toughness of the sound, you know the heaviness of it, that the Irish crowd certainly weren't quite prepared for you. I think it'd be fair to say that day.
I think we did really well, actually. My recollection of Dolly Mount was, well, first of all, we had Motorhead's monitor guy, Eagle, doing our monitors. And quite frankly, to this day, I don't think I've ever heard monitors as clear and as loud as that day. And we played, I remember it was such a pleasure to play under those conditions. I remember it was one of the best feeling as far as for performance. How did we go over? Well, we didn't have anything thrown at us.
And yeah. People
generally cheered us on. So I would say we did well. So my recollection is that it was pretty damn good. I can still remember Dee Snider running in to meet Lemmy for the first time in our change room very, very quickly before we went on. I can still remember Black Sabbath walking through the guys and saying hello to them, and they're, yeah, hello, guys, because we met them at another earlier point. Great. It was a lot of fun.
It was a great day out as a spectator as well. Well, one other memory I have of that day is that there was a serious amount of the PA kit was actually stacked underneath the stage. And when you guys came on, and particularly also when Motorhead came on, there was a large number of people peeling away from the front. It was so loud.
Because you haven't played in Ireland. We're both from Ireland, but you guys haven't played there too much over the years. I mean, I guess you've done a lot of European tours, Eastern Europe, but it's a shame. I've never said it.
We've been dabbling with Ireland in recent tours. We've been finally getting over there.
Yeah. Because you played in Belfast, basically.
We had a lot of trouble coming back. And the movie struck really well there. We actually went to there was a film festival in Galway that we actually attended.
Okay.
Which is actually kind of some funny stuff going on there. A lady comes up to Rob and goes, you guys aren't a real band. And he says, we are. And he goes, well, your name must be made up. You got the same name as the guy that did Spinal Tap. He goes, yeah, but I got my passport. He shows her the passport and she goes, oh, you Hollywood types, you can get anything printed.
Well, I mean, to be honest, if I was at the Galway Film Festival and you guys turned up, I would think you weren't the real guys. Why would you come to Galway of all places? Like, so, but
we did an Anvil Experience. We played a theater. We played in a theater after the movie ran. We did that, and that was spectacular. I remember that being quite good.
You tend to find, I don't know, Michael's probably agree that Irish fans and Scottish fans are always very positive towards sort of heavy metal over the years. Certainly, I'm from Northern Ireland, from Belfast, and during the Troubles we had, the only bands that came to play in Belfast was the heavy metal bands. We had Metallica, we had Slayer and stuff. They came. All the other kind of poppy bands didn't show up. They weren't tough enough for that. Like, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we could take if I could take you back to one of your seminal albums, guys, Metal on Metal is a cracking album. The title track's got to have one of the best metal riffs of all time, Lips. Can you tell us about that song in terms of how it came up? The riff is obviously one that's a real kind of earworm.
Trying to figure out what he just asked me.
the metal on metal riff.
Oh, I one of thousands of riffs that I've come up with.
Yeah.
Did I realize what it was when I first did it? Not really. I mean, it ended up being iconic and having and never being never going away. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It still sounds fresh as a daisy.
For that album, I thought that the actual song "Metal on Metal" had the least integrity of the entire album. but at the same time, it had the simplicity that would propel it. You know, that it would be easy to lock into for anybody to hear it once and go, "Hey, that's cool." But
yeah,
as far as integrity and songs like that, I mean, obviously. Songs that actually meant a hell of a lot more to the genre are obviously March of the Crabs, 666, even Mothra. You know, these are the songs that actually set up a whole new genre that they called speed metal. So, you know, songs like Jackhammer, things like that, that no one was really doing at that time. I thought they were a lot more influential. Metal on Metal was although we're known and everybody says, hey, these are the speed metal pioneers, the only song that everybody knows by us is Metal on Metal, and it isn't speed metal. So yeah. There's a little bit of this disjointed reality in there. So
yeah, another
it leaves me feeling, you know.
And another song from that album that is still part of the set is Mothra, which you mentioned earlier. It's a bit of an unusual song for its time in terms of, you know, writing a song about a Japanese sort of movie monster. You were a bit ahead of your time. I mean, people wouldn't think twice about writing a song about a superhero these days or a cartoon character. Were you a big fan of the Godzilla movies when you were a kid?
Yeah, of course. It's part of growing up in the 60s, you know.
Okay.
That was the entertainment. That and what do you call that? Marionette.
Thunderbirds.
Thunderbirds. Fireball XL5. You know.
Okay. And does that song get a particular reaction then when you play it in Japan, or is that just same everywhere? I guess. But
no, we had no. We wrote the song actually before we ever went to Japan.
Okay. But do you find the Japanese fans are more up for it?
No influence on the writing of that song at all. None. And I would say if anything had an influence was Blue Oyster Cult doing Godzilla.
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. So, but I mean, one of the early albums that when you guys started going, I mean, you obviously brought you to attention of other bands. I mean, there's one story about Lemmy asked you to join Motorhead. Is that a true story or is that a rumor? Rumor.
Yeah, after, of course, he got to know who we were because we opened for him our very first show after we changed the name from Lips to Anvil. We opened for Motorhead like 2 days after our first album came out. And about a year later, they came to play the Coliseum in Toronto for the Iron Fist tour. And Lemmy had some difficulties with some kind of muscle spasms in his arm, and he ended the show early, and that prompted Eddie Clark to quit. The next morning, we got a call from Doug Smith, their manager, asking me to join the band, which I didn't do because, of course, I was in the midst of recording and writing the Forged in Fire album, our third album, and I wasn't going to leave my band to go join another band. I'm making a name for myself, and it wasn't really something that seemed plausible at the time. It's just, you know, I'm under contract. I'm obligated to stay with Anvil. So no, and the answer was no, and I didn't do it.
Yeah.
As a result, the level of respect was extraordinary between the two bands. And Lemmy asked us to come and play all over the UK in 83 on another Perfect tour.
Okay. It must have been quite cool to be asked, though, to join a band like that point, Motorhead, who were, you know, kicking ass all over the place at that point. So.
Yeah, it's kind of it's just not meant to be.
No, that's fair enough then. So
he wasn't going to join Anvil. I wasn't going to join Motorhead.
No. Oh no, that would be. I mean, have you played together on stage together? I can't think if you have,
never,
but I mean,
never have.
No, yeah.
We got drunk and high on speed together, but we didn't play together.
Okay. I mean, but going back to your early days, guys, and you know, coming from Canada, I mean, there's lots of good Canadian rock bands. But was it tough at that point? There's a lot of bands from New York and the West Coast of the States, and was that hard to get noticed?
When we first started out, there was no such thing as heavy metal.
Okay. Yeah.
In North America, we started well before it. We're kind of a band that, in a certain sense, fell in the crack between hard rock and heavy metal. And our first album is much more of a rock album. And by the time the second album, we got very, very tuned into the new wave of British heavy metal and became part of that actual scene.
Okay.
And that influenced somewhat some of the sounds that we, in songs that we chose and the things that we chose to use to go that way. We got really intrigued by playing high speed. And we started applying jazz-oriented speed to our music. People misinterpreted it and call it speed metal, but the origins actually come from jazz, you know, like from swing.
Wow.
You know, we talk about the song Motor Mount. It's actually a sort of a glorified metal version of a swing song. So to me, because that's it's could have been horns, but it's guitar. So yeah, and instead of playing and the other thing is that's misinterpreted. We're not a thrash band. Never were. You know, thrash is playing snare, bass drum, dutton, 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 and playing fast on the guitar. We didn't do that. We play double bass drum beats, which is more glorified or more pigeonholed into speed metal, really, or power metal. You know, thrash is a lot more punk, really.
Yeah, I would never say you're a punk.
The other thing that we came to realize, most drummers can't really play very well with double bass drum. So you do 1-2 beats and you play the guitar the same. Okay. So that turns into thrash. So it's an easier way to do it. And the same thing that happened with vocals. A lot of guys couldn't sing high, couldn't sing like a Rob Halford and whatnot. So they started yelling and barking, and then it turned into the thrash that we know. It has no melody in the vocals and super fast riffs. And that's how that got created, is more, in my opinion, from lack of talent than from growth of talent. So,
yeah.
I could be wrong, and it's just from my point of view and my perspective, that's how it came across to me. And I'm going, they're going, hey, you guys are an influence, and I'm going, I don't hear it. You know, they're telling me I'm an influence, and I'm going, I never did anything like that in any of my music. Why are you saying that I've influenced you? Right. So I completely get. But on the other side of it, it's okay. You know, you say that I influence you. Okay. I'm good with that. Whatever. You can call me anything you want. Just don't call me late for supper.
Yeah. maybe it was just the attitude that you guys had as well. It wasn't so much the music influence, but you know, they like the attitude, they like the look of the band, and you were, you know, again, pretty iconic, and you know, coming out in your kind of that kind of bondage gear you used to wear in early days and stuff. And
yeah, it was time and era, you know. There was a time that it seemed like it was cool to do that.
Would you do it but today?
It's been 40 years since I did that, so it's well out of place at the time.
Do you still have it?
Yes, it's in my tool shed. Absolutely, you open the suitcase and you could die from the smell of mildew on the leather.
But you don't when you're home on your time off, you don't kind of slip it on just for old time's sake. I mean, I can see you in that, Michael. Actually,
I think that's a no. But Stephen, you know, your point is interesting about bands taking influence in that. I mean, oftentimes for younger bands starting off, I mean, the immediate attraction to get into music is probably to play and sound like their heroes, and then they find out that they can't do that because you know they don't have the technical skill to do it, or as you say, they can't sing or what have you. And that it's oftentimes the mistakes that you make when you're playing that make music a wee bit interesting, maybe.
It could be. It's like we talk about bands who are playing live, and you almost wait for them to make a mistake so that you can find the difference to what the album sounded like. I make a mistake. You know, I could say that Metal on Metal was a mistake because I didn't sing it melodically enough. You know what I mean? And then that turned into thrash. I don't know. It's like, you know, when people say that I'm an influence and I created thrash, it's really, I almost take it as an insult. So it's weird, you know. But sometimes I find that pretty weird, you know.
Here's an interesting thing. So my kids are late 20s now, guys, and they certainly were not into heavy metal in any way, shape or form. I was when I was younger, but some of them got into Anvil, bizarrely, through the film, the story of Anvil. We watched the movie and they went straight out and listened to some stuff. And we were talking about it the other day, actually. I watched it again, and that film must have affected you. I mean, did that give you a sort of catalyst for more to keep going, or?
We're going to keep going regardless of the movie.
Yeah, okay. All
that's the, actually yeah. The whole point.
Right.
That movie just sure. Exemplifies the fact that we would have kept going.
Yeah.
The movie just filming us as we were keeping going, we were recording our 13th album.
Yes.
The misconception and the misunderstanding, it's not a band that was not successful. If you're not successful, you don't record 13 albums. Sorry, I had to do all that. And I know what that meant. And every time you go do a record, you have to sell enough on your last one to make it worthwhile for the label to keep going.
Sure.
Right? And that's success.
But, right? Yeah.
Success is getting your songs written, recorded, and released. And yeah. We did that 12 times before the movie happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we were unsuccessful, you would say, well, after their third album, they fell into obscurity and never did another record. Now they're doing their fourth record 20 years later. That's unsuccessful.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But, I mean, it must have given you a bit of a boost in terms of kind of coverage and stuff again, because, you know, it was a very, you know, it's a great watch. It's really interesting, life on the road.
No, it changed everything. It completely changed the whole path of everything, of course. And yeah. It actually, instead of being in the underground, we had massive, massive publicity. The most that made anything that happens in the music industry look like a joke. When you do a movie, there's no comparison. The amount of people and the amount of promotion and the amount of work that it takes to get a movie to the general public and popular is so enormous. And the hundreds of little contingencies to make that climb, it goes way, way, way beyond anything and in fact, it circumvented the whole music industry.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people in the music industry that point their finger, oh, they made it because of a movie. Wrong.
Sure.
Yeah, and I mean, wrong.
Without the music and the love of the fan who created the movie, there'd be no movie.
Yep.
Yeah. And the director and filmmaker was an ex Anvil roadie, Sasha Gervaisi. So, we had a guy who obviously loved the band.
He was a fan that we met at the Marquee in 1982 when we played there, when we went to play the Donington Festival. You know, if we want to talk about the Donington Festival, it was actually much more important in a certain sense that we played the Marquee in London, because that's where we made Sasha and where we met Sasha. And that guy was the most powerful person that we had ever met, that changed everything for our entire career. That is much more relevant to actually talk about. And the thing is that, had we not been the open people that we are and the friendly people that we are, when this kid came to our change room, he was 14 years old, you don't turn somebody like that away. You invite them in and you let them hang out. And he was a wonderful, wonderful kid. He knew everything about us and we were intrigued. It was our first, time coming to UK, and here's somebody that knows everything that we do, that we have done inside out. And it was great, you know.
And that was pre-internet days as well, Steve. So, you know, not that easy to get the information in the first place.
About the music and wanted to know everything about us. And to the point where, of course, he had family and stuff in Toronto, where we come from. And hence he showed up in Toronto. You know, knock, knock at my door, and there he is. I go, Teabag, what are you doing here? You know, and from the, you know, so we made very, very close friends with him, and it changed his life. It kind of helped. It really changed his life. And when he finally grew up and sort of got to a point where he was successful at what he was going after, which was becoming a screenwriter and working for Steven Spielberg, he contacted me. And we hadn't heard from him in 25 years. And during that 25 years, we put out 12 albums, which was intriguing to him. He's going, I got to get together with you. And he had me come to Los Angeles. And from that, we had a great get together there. And we ended up going to a very, very prominent Hollywood guy by the name of Steve Zalian. And we went to his house, and who's a very good friend of Sasha. And the guy was like, who the hell did you bring to my house, right? And Sasha starts telling him about who I am and what I've done. And the guy goes, you got to make a movie about this. He says, mingling with these guys and knowing them since you were a kid, only you could make this movie, and you should do this. This could be something very, very special. Well, of course, unbeknown to me at the moment, I had no idea that that's where this was going. I get back to Toronto. The next thing I'm hearing is he's coming up to Toronto. He wants to talk to me. So we go to his uncle's place, and he sits me down and he says, I'm making a movie about you. And at that point, I realized my ship just came in.
Yep.
I might have missed the ship in 83 or 84 when we got involved with the huge management from the States, and it shattered all of our chances and pulled us right out of the stream at the most important time in heavy metal between 1983 and 1987. We didn't put out albums. You're dead in the water. And that, in order to right that wrong, you're going to need something enormous and spectacular to bring you back into the public view. Yeah. And this happening, when the guy says, I'm going to make a movie, and this guy's worked with Steven Spielberg, it's not some idiot with a video camera, it's real Hollywood. I'm going, Hollywood is going to make a movie about Anvil. I'm going big. Here's my chance. I wasn't wrong.
Yeah,
I'm 15 years after the fact, and the movie is being re-released again for the second time, which is also completely unprecedented. That just never happens. Come on, there'd be 20 commandments if the 10 commandments came.
No, I love the movie. I love the bits, you know, even the bits not touring where you're just driving around in the cold in your van delivering food. I mean, do you still do that as a when you're home or?
No, we don't have no day jobs.
No, we don't need.
No, not anymore, okay.
Let's put it this way.
The band is a shitty day job.
We became a really hot item on all the film festivals all over the world. As soon as that happened, the day jobs were history.
Okay.
You're going all over the world, and the movie hasn't even officially come out, and you're already traveling all over the world and doing these Q&As, and it started to rise almost immediately.
Okay.
That's great. And, you know, it kind of justifies you guys playing the long game, doing the thing that you love. And
that's what success is. Success is really, it's a really simple to define. Success is doing what you love, getting away with it, and getting paid enough to continue.
Yeah.
That is 100% success, period. Making millions of dollars, don't even talk about that. Everybody's working on their first million. So it's not about that. About being working on that.
Yeah.
It's about having the opportunity to make $1 million is success. It's not $1 million.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I admire your enthusiasm, Steve. Yeah. We're probably going to need to let you go shortly. But
one thing, though. I listened to your new album, Impact is Imminent, which is a great album, by the way. And I love the bit at the start with Dave Grohl. How did that come about, right at the start?
Well, that's really interesting because that was from a film festival. It was somewhat of a film festival, but not really. It was the Spirit Awards, which is part of the Academy Awards, right? It's the Independent Spirit Awards. It's like the Academy Awards for independent movies.
Right.
Because Sasha made that movie and financed it himself. It's independent. And we won. So what happened was the VH1 people asked Dave Grohl if he'd be interested to introduce us. And he goes, I'm compelled to do it. So he came up to the microphone and, well, actually, even on his arrival, it was absolutely, I'd never met the man. He pulls up in a limousine, gets out with a beautiful, beautiful woman and a really nice guitar in a case, right? And I'm thinking, oh, I guess Dave's going to come up and play metal on metal with us. And he walks up to me, puts the guitar down. He goes, this is a gift I'm giving you. I'm giving back because you deserve this. And you're the only other guitar player I can think of that would understand what a semi-hollow Gibson means.
Oh, wow. Like,
what? Yeah, well, I cherish the thing. But what a way to meet somebody. The guy gives you a beautiful, beautiful Gibson signature Dave Grohl guitar as a gift and goes, hello, here I am. And then he comes out and introduces the band. And everything that he said was completely from the heart. He got to include all these things when you go up to the mic to introduce them. And he just ripped it up and walked up to the mic and said what he did. Okay, so move forward to the album. Of course, we're not even thinking about that. I wrote the song, Take a Lesson, and it was about my experiences, what the movie did to my life and how it changed everything and how I was able to look at it in a retrospect and be able to look at all the enemies that wished I would fail left behind in a cloud of dust. You're saying that, you know? And the producer calls me in into the control room during mixing, and he clicks the thing on. And then all of a sudden, the Dave Grohl entrance, and it starts into the song. I'm going, oh, my God, that's genius, because the song, everything that he said was almost a reflection of the song. He's going, a lesson in this, a lesson in that, a lesson. And it's like, it's all about taking a lesson. It's like, That couldn't fit better. It's like I wrote the song to accompany his speech, but we were never meant to be together, not on purpose. It was the producer that actually came up with the idea. And I was like, wow, that's incredible.
No, it sounds like it was made to happen, actually.
We lifted that speech and use it to open our shows now.
Oh, really? Oh, fantastic. So,
well, Steve and Rob, you're about a third of the way through your European tour. You've got Scandinavia, France, Germany, and Spain and Portugal to come. There's people listening to our podcast all over the place. So what can our European friends expect when Anvil hit town over the next few weeks?
They're going to see three guys who are like kids in a candy shop having the time of their life on stage and trying to spread the good feeling of being happy and fulfilled. That's what they're going to see. And it can be overwhelming. Some people I've got to tell you, man, what I've been experiencing on this UK tour, I've never seen anything like it. It's not unusual for me to start the show in the crowd, but I started this thing on the American run where we play a completely full set so that you're including stuff that you would normally use as encores, right? So you're playing right to the end. So instead of just ending the song on stage and then everybody cheers you on to come up back up, I end the show out in the crowd the same way that I started. And then I start shaking everybody's hand and no one asks for an encore. They're too busy trying to hug me and kiss me. I mean, and it's literally men hugging, kissing me on the cheek. I mean, I don't know that I never felt love like that. And it's not, I think it's unusual. And I think it is directly connected to the movie in the sense that the movie makes you feel like you know me, like I'm your brother.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And yep. When I'm out there in person, they get to actually touch that person and they know that I'm real. And it's the most genuine show you're ever going to be attending. I mean, that's what you can expect by seeing Anvil. It is absolutely 100% genuine. There is no facade. There is no bullshit. It's what it is. We are what we are. We do what we do. And we love our audience and the audience loves us. We love to be there with all our hearts and give everything we've got for those moments.
And it's good for the soul for all concerned, isn't it? It's an uplifting experience.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. And once again, it's spontaneous and stuff just happens. I've been ending the show out in the crowd. And of course, at the end of Metal on Metal, if the song is an F. But what has happened is our sound man and tour manager runs the song Sweet Caroline at the end of the show.
Oh, God.
So what happens is when the section of the song when it comes up, hands, touching hands, reaching. Everybody's got their hands in the air trying to touch my hands. And then the whole place is singing Sweet Caroline. Good times never been so good. And it's unbelievable that a metal crowd is singing Neil Diamond.
Well, I wish I could see that tonight. Looks like that would be amazing.
It's a phenomenon, but at the same time, it has such, it's so heartwarming. It's overwhelming, actually. I stay on that in the crowd until the last person's had their autograph. I'm literally out there for an hour after the show, at least.
You must be exhausted.
Taking pictures, shaking hands. And fulfillment for me, fuck, it just doesn't get better.
No.
I mean, it's one thing to read that somebody liked the show or you're hearing from the audience. But I mean, hundreds of people at once telling you that they love you and they taking your hand. It just doesn't get more gratifying.
Yep, people need love, Leps, that's for sure. Like, so.
Good. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you both on. Good luck with the rest of the tour. You'll be looking forward to a nice lie down when you get back to Canada after all this, Rob, will you?
Yeah, well, you always have to go home.
back in time for winter, maybe.
The tour ends and you have to go home, but there's always another tour and another album.
So is it going to be, when do you record the next album, do you think?
Next August, yeah.
Next year, okay. We'll look forward to that then. So that'll be excellent.
I've got all the music already written. I'm slowly compiling lyrics at this point.
Okay,
so it's almost done.
I'm going to leave you one final thought. I hope James is recording your performance tonight, because then you can have a live album called Anvil at the Anvil.
Somebody will be recording it. That's for sure.
Well, all right. All right. Thanks for your time, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers. Well,
one thing to West of it is they were Anvil were playing at the Anvil in Bournemouth, which is a rock club that's kind of a subterranean rock club. But it turns out there's quite a few venues called the Anvil that they were playing at. Some coincidence, maybe not.
Okay. And apologies for the slightly ropey sound quality in the interview. I mean, we got a little bit of a taster of, you know, the mundane side of being on the road there, didn't we, with the two of them sitting on a sofa with a laptop propped up in front of them.
It certainly didn't look very rock and roll.
No.
And, you know, it was almost, I mean, they were very, I mean, I thought, I mean, to be honest, from our side, we thought at the start we'd lost them a bit because they weren't entirely on board with our line of questioning at the start. But I think once the lips warmed up, I think we were in the bag. That was good, actually. So.
Yeah. I think you really upset them with that very anodyne question about Donington. But anyway.
Well, I mean, we thought that was a kind of a reasonable place to start. But I guess, and I, you know, they are touring their new album, which, again, check it out. Impact is Imminent, which actually I listened to the other day again, and it is very good. It's got a little intro from Dave Grohl, which was, and he was obviously very keen to talk about that. So, no, I really enjoyed it. And if you get a chance to see them, they're playing around Europe and other places, and I'm sure they'll be back in the UK next year.
We will look forward to that when they do come. Okay, Terry, a couple of reviews for this week. You have been at the Aberdeen Comedy Festival, which was on recently, and I know nothing about this, so you have to guide me through it.
Well, it's funny because I was volunteering at the show. I had bought some tickets, and then I was volunteering at some events. So, and one of the benefits of volunteering is you get to go to a few events and see the comedian to work. You're working there, doing the doors stuff, and you also get to get some free tickets to go and see it. It's quite a big festival. I mean, it was running for about 10 days across various venues in the city, from the Music Hall, the Tivoli. They had stuff on at like the Park Inn. They had stuff on in pubs. There was some free shows. It kicked off with two nights from David O'Doherty, and there's a link to a review coming shortly. But David talks about his time in lockdown at Achill Island with his parents. David O'Doherty is immensely entertaining. I saw him the first night. I bought my own ticket. Second night, I was volunteering. Both shows were pretty unique, I would say, which was great. So I didn't feel like I'd seen it before. Who else did I see? I saw a guy, Alan Cochrane. He was playing at the Park Inn, who was pretty close to the edge on the COVID. There was a few deep intakes of breath for that. And I saw Daniel Sloss at the Music Hall, which was an extravaganza. He had like five support acts. So as a festival, I think it's, I mean, they had Harry Hill on, they had Milton Jones, they had Olga Koch, they had, oh God, you name it, Hal Cruttenden was on. So they put an effort in. The only thing they don't do, and a few folk commented on it, was they don't do the multi-ticket discount sort of thing, which they could maybe look at. But they said the problem is it's different venues, and it's hard to do. And they've got the Tivoli. I mean, they're not all Aberdeen performing arts venues either. So,
Yeah, and I mean, you know, without meaning to criticize this festival, but
No.
that the price of going to comedy gigs has really galloped ahead now the last few years, and it's not an inexpensive night out anymore, is it?
No, and I didn't quite get some of the pricing. I mean, there was the Friday night I was at the Park Inn, which is a nice little venue, maybe 40 or 50 seats sort of thing. They had three events on, and each event was individually ticketed. So if you were buying one for each, it would have cost you upwards of 45 quid. Whereas you could have gone to the music hall on the same night for Daniel Sloss and seen five support acts for an hour and a half and Daniel Sloss for an hour and a half for 25 quid. So, but it's a bigger show. It's a, you know, it's 1,200 people, you know, at the music hall, blah, blah, blah. They're going to get drink sales and all the rest. So, but it's a good event. It's well organized. I mean, some people I met who had volunteered and done events twice a day, every single day, and it doesn't run without the volunteers. But at the same time, there's people at my work who'd never heard of it, didn't know it was on. There's always that. There's always somebody who hasn't heard about it. So, but no, very good, I think, and it's going to be. I'm sure it'll be back next year. They do get a good acts come along now. So, and some local talent as well. So that was good.
Good. Okay. And you mentioned David O'Doherty being from Achill Island. Our movie review this year, this episode this year, was partly set in Achill, and that's the third part of Martin McDonagh's Aran Islands trilogy. It's called Banshees of Inisherin, and you have witnessed it, Terry, and I suppose the coming back together of
Yeah.
Gleeson and Colin Farrell.
I went to see it at the weekend. It's certainly set in Achill Island, which is a very, you know, bleak and beautiful island of the west coast of Ireland, off County Mayo. It's an interesting film. It's obviously he's made a couple of films before with them. He did In Bruges. He also did Three Billboards, which was, you know, had a bit of a message in it. This one, people at work were asking me, should they go and see it? I said, well, it's not Father Ted. I mean, it's funny. It's hilariously funny in parts. It's also super dark in bits. Brendan Gleeson, and basically the story is about two friends, and Brendan Gleeson decides that he doesn't want to be Colin Farrell's pal anymore.
Because he's the strange idiot boy type
He
character, isn't he, in the
is, but he's not that much of an idiot. I mean, he's just a bit of a happy-go-lucky character, and he lives with his sister, and his sister's fed up with the island as well. It's a small island. It's an interesting. We thought it was going to be a bit of a subplot about the sort of the Civil War because they kept hearing explosions from the mainland. But that never transpired as part of the story, and it is really about the two. And it's an old witch that lives on the island as well, and there's a grumpy policeman who beats people up. But it's a great story. I mean, Brendan Gleeson is fantastic, and the two of them sparring is fantastic. It's really good all the way through, and but it does get quite dark, certainly as the film progresses. But it's certainly worth going to see. I really enjoyed it, and
Yeah.
Colin Farrell, I think, is getting stronger and stronger every time I see him, actually. So.
Mark Kermode's described it as a flawless tragicomedy of male friendship gone sour.
I would say that's absolutely perfect. I mean, there's anim I mean, there's oh my God! I can't even think of. I'm just thinking about the animals now. That's horrible as well. Like giving too many plot spoilers away.
It.
I mean, it's a bit gruesome. The witch bit's a bit creepy because it's just kind of, you know, she's kind of like this witch that kind of hangs about and predicts people's deaths and stuff and things. And so it's 1920s Ireland. So they're all going about in horse and carts. It's very stylized. What folk think Ireland's like today, which I'm sure in modern it probably is, Andrew, Michael,
Oh, yeah, right.
yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was going to make a point about this without having seen the movie, but just seen a couple of clips of it. And it's about the way that maybe the depiction of Ireland back in those days before kind of economic development, that, our kind of recollection of it was very much kind of framed by movies like The Quiet Man and Ryan's Daughter. And the basically the Irish were a bit thick and all that kind of stuff. And things that like this movie, Martin McDonagh's work in general, and maybe even Father Ted to a certain extent, have kind of reclaimed that landscape a wee bit. And we kind of own it again now, the depiction of Ireland. I mean, you don't see Far and Away, the Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman movie on TV a whole pile these days, do you? Because it's like such a stereotypical view of what life was like in Ireland back then.
No, I think I think this film certainly, you know, it's a very historical piece. It's not, you know, it's not trying to be in any way sort of modern or anything. But no, you're right. I mean, the Tom Cruise American accent sort of thing was just ridiculous, clearly, wasn't it, at the time. So they hopefully stop doing that now. I'm guessing they get a good funding to film in Ireland as well. They've always have done over the years. I mean, my wife, I like to point out to all the Scots that Braveheart was actually filmed in Ireland, but that's, we better not go down that one. But no, you're right. But it's, yeah, I mean, certainly, again, folk at work, I said, just be careful. If you're going expecting a happy-go-lucky, quiet man stroke Father Ted, this is not the film. But you know, something a bit deeper. And it does feel like The Quiet Man in the fact of the locations. I mean, it looks beautiful. I mean, it looks bleak at times. Small, lots of stone walls. And yeah, no, good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, but poetic rather than cliched. So
yeah. And I've been to Achill Island, but I can't remember it. It was a long time ago. But I would say
I can remember going to it, because I remember going to, I think it was Kiel Strand, which is like a very kind of rocky cove with a very deep raked sandy beach on it. And I ran straight into the water and then I ran straight back out again. It was incredibly cold.
All right.
Absolutely freezing. So yeah, that's my recollection of it.
Well, I've definitely planned to go back. I mean, I know I've got a lot of friends in Mayo, and it is a sort of beautiful, that's the Wild Atlantic Way sort of thing. So if you get a chance, but
certainly. So it was a scary experience, which is a perfect link to our little mini Halloween themed bit, Terry.
Yes,
scary
yes.
Movies. You got any favorites?
I do. The ones I would watch a lot of, and I was watching one last night, is The Fog, which mm-hmm. is John Carpenter, The Thing, another great film, and there's one which is a Scandinavian one called Let the Right One In.
Oh yes.
So I haven't seen that one, but someone made a joke this week, and I'm just going to look at my phone here, and it was that film crossed with the Conservative Party, and it was Let the Far Right One In. so that's a shout out to who told me that? That was Rick McMurray from Ash told me that this week.
Oh, very good, Rick.
Well, that was very funny. So those are my favourite. I would like those films. I could watch those films over and over again.
Well done, Onion Rick. Right, okay. I had a minor overlap, so because I had The Thing on mine as well, so I will need to substitute that. But my first two were American Werewolf in London.
Oh, okay.
And The Exorcist. Uh-huh. And I'm going to go for another Stephen King styley one. How about The Dead Zone with Christopher Walken?
Oh, that's a bit of a left wing one there, but left field. That's I didn't see that one coming.
Do you remember? He did the kind of, after he'd had the accident, he was the laying on of hands, and he would suddenly, you know, be able to read your mind and your future.
Oh, I've not seen that film for. Oh, I was just trying to look for some films to watch this weekend for Halloween, and that might be a good one to go back to actually.
Yeah, and scary songs, Terry. You got any particular favourites there?
I do. So I've got. We may have an overlap here, actually. I have Werewolves of London, Warren Zevon, Iron Maiden, The Number of the Beast. It's a good one. And then I was trying to think of another one, and I thought, let's go for this one. The Devil Rides Down to Georgia.
Oh, yes.
Which I thought was quite a good one.
Charlie Daniels Band. Well, I had a couple of spares in here as well, but the ones I picked were Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus, which is quite scary anyway.
That's good.
How about Sarone's Supernature, which, if you listen to the lyrics of it, it's about escaped mutant creatures that had been made in a lab to end human starvation, but they rebel against their makers. And actually, if you look at the cover of the Supernature single, it's guys with lab coats wearing pigs' heads. It is quite scary. And my third one is I Married a Monster from Outer Space by John Cooper Clarke, but honourable mentions also to Jacko's Thriller, Bobby Boris Pickett and the Crypt Kickers' Monster Mash. You remember that one?
I think that's a good one.
And finally, Amityville, the House on the Hill song by Lovebug Starsky.
That's a good one.
And well, that concludes my selection.
Well, I also had People Are Strange by Echo and the Bunnymen, only because it's in that film, The Lost Boys. But I don't think the song relates to Halloween really very much. I think it's just the fact that people are a bit strange. And I also had Bad Moon Rising, but again, that was in American Werewolf in London.
It was, yeah.
Which is, once again, I don't think until it was associated with that, I ever thought about it that way. But it's a good film. So
good. So I'm going to have a selection of toffee apples, and I'm going to scare the shit out of my neighbours this evening, Terry. How about you?
I've got some pumpkin spice latte IPA, I think it is, from Fierce Beer. So I might have one of those later on then. So
good. Okay, that's it from us for this episode. We'll be back before you know it. Till the next time, Terry.
See you soon. Bye.